I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Last week, I was reading Shannon Roop's latest on the Taiz website, talking about two forthcoming productions of the same play, Oleana. The David Mamet play is being staged first, the 19th to the 27th of April, at the Little Mountain Gallery at Main and 26th. Then Bleeding Heart Theatre will be producing a run at the Havana Theatre on Commercial Drive, the 6th through the 18th of May, 2014. Joining me now is David Bloom. He plays a professor in this first production who was confronted by a female student in a drama that sets off an exposition about the student-teacher relationship, sexual harassment, political correctness, feminism, and more. I'll get Mr. Bloom to tell us as much as is reasonable about this show and this forthcoming production. He co-stars with Pandora Morgan, and the production is directed by Wilhelmina Sparrow.
Wilhelmina Sparrow, that's right.
David Bloom is a playwright, actor, director, and fight choreographer. He is co-artistic director of Felix Culpa and is on the faculty at Langara College and Capilano University. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, David Bloom. Mr. Bloom, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So how do people get tickets to run from the 19th to the 27th of April at the Little Mountain Gallery?
There's two ways you can get tickets. One is you can just walk up to the door before 7:30. The show starts at 7:30 on six nights during that time, and there's the possibility that you'll get in. Or you can send an email to coleana@gmail.com. That's C as in to watch, OLEANNA@gmail.com, and you can reserve that way.
So you're in the midst of rehearsing this production, but you've
worked on
this play in the past, is that right?
Yes, I had choreographed. There's some violence in the piece, and I also choreograph violence for theater quite often, and so many years ago I had choreographed violence for one or two productions. I'm getting old and I can't remember everything. I'm not sure if it was one or two. So I'd seen the show a couple of times, and I'd read it, and I'd found it disturbing, and I hadn't particularly liked it in a lot of ways. In fact, I'd found that I often I didn't trust the play back then. I thought it was slanted. I thought and I thought it was possibly misogynist, which a number of people do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, interestingly, Pandora Morgan, at the time that she was actually Pandora's idea to do the play, and at the time that she first proposed it, she was a student of mine. She suggested it in a class, and I assumed that she was making a dig at me and that it was a joke. And I was like, yeah, right. And then when she graduated from the program, this is the Studio 58 Theater School, she came up to me and said, I was quite serious about that. I would like to do this play, and you're the person I want to do it with. I'm not quite sure what that says about me, but so we got together. I said, okay, well, let's read it, because it's been a long time. And we read the play, and two things made me really want to do it. One is that I actually felt a bit sick at the end of the reading. It's disturbing, and it's difficult. But also that when we read the text, it felt like a very different play than any production I'd actually seen of it. Somehow, it felt like every production I'd seen really slanted the sort of aimed for the audience sympathy to be squarely with the professor. It would be like, well, he's a little pompous, but, you know, maybe he's a little insensitive, but ultimately he doesn't deserve what happens to him. And it's like, well, neither of the characters ultimately deserve what happens to them, or they both do. I mean, I think it actually is what Mamet's claimed it is, which is a story of a power struggle between two people, and ultimately a tragedy about two people who just need things from each other and cannot speak the same language.
Now Mamet has this reputation of, in recent years, I guess, of being not as liberal as some of his contemporaries in the American theater.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that back around Oleana and before that, Mamet was definitely considered a leftist. I mean, he was a pugnacious leftist, and he was also, I remember he wrote an essay about guns where he said, I'm a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union and the National Rifle Association, and I didn't join either of them to make friends. And he was a very strong voice for the left about, you know, Vietnam, about a whole lot of issues. And then, as he's gotten older, as Winston Churchill suggested, he has become quite right-wing.
Yeah.
And this, it feels in a way like this play, sometimes when we're looking at it, I think, this must have been when he was right. This is almost like an argument between the left, the lefty side of him and the right side of him in a lot of ways. And his production, both his theater production and his film of this thing, really do seem to make the woman look like a stereotype of... there's a kind of a stereotype that a lot of people have about feminism, that which I think is unjustified, but which is really prevalent in society. And he really made the woman in the production he filmed shrill and... humorless and vindictive, and a lot of other things. But Mamet the writer, I think, made her much more interesting than Mamet the director did. And then having somebody as smart and intense and who's lived the life that Pandora Morgan has, and then being directed by Helena Sparrow, who is a playwright and an actor, a really smart woman as well, who's been around, who's lived, she's been a lot of different places in her life, but she's originally from the Musqueam Reserve, and she has a lot of insight into power structure, colonialism, hidden, the way power can manifest itself, and the play's all about power. So having those two, being in the room with these two women, we're constantly finding complex things. Moment to moment, you just find yourself thinking, how can anybody not agree with her? And then, how could anybody agree with what she's, it's really, what we want is to make it hard for the audience to pick a side.
So what have you learned in the 20 years or so, or what have you come to realize in the 20 years or so since you first saw it and now performing it? Has the play changed for you, do you think?
I don't think, obviously the way I'm reading the play has changed. I think part of it is that the conversation about sexual harassment and power structures and things like that in universities and things like that may have shifted and changed, and I think that our understanding of, I'm going to use some buzzwords here, but our understanding of things like male privilege, or understanding of what many people call rape culture is, these are still divisive concepts, and there's still areas where people are going to fight and argue, but it's harder to just write those ideas off. They're obviously part of very complex aspects of society. I think what's happened is that the play has actually become massively relevant and pertinent again. This last summer, you might remember when Blurred Lines was the most popular song.
Right.
And this argument was happening around that song. Is it just a fun song about a maybe sleazy pickup, or is it actually an anthem to rape? And you have people on either side of that thing. And the argument there would become incredibly vociferous. And the fact is, there's a whole lot of areas where power manifests itself that don't respond well to legal solutions, don't respond well to black and white solutions, because human beings are complicated and they can often be doing three or four things at the exact same moment. you can be exerting your power and powerless, within seconds of the same, with the same action. And somehow, I think it is in this play possible to address these things. And I'm really hoping that that's what we're going to bring out. The complexity of the human tragedy that sometimes manifests itself when power becomes the issue between anybody, between men and women, between, academics and students. This play also really deals a lot. Deep in the DNA of the play is a class difference as well.
Yeah.
Because the woman really is from a different class. She's clearly the only person in her family who's ever made it to university. She has not, she alludes to some of the stuff she's had to go through to get there. And they're, they're not sharing the same language.
Did you know that there was another production coming up as well?
Well, what happened, it's been 3 years since Pandora first proposed the project to me, and I said, I'll do it if we can get a woman director that I really trust. And we, amidst various other projects that we were both independently doing, we would periodically meet with women who we were interested in working with and read it to them, and they were either unavailable or uninterested or whatever. So it took us 3 years to really make the connection with the person we really wanted to do it with. And then around the time that we started preparing to make it finally happen, I was contacted by Evan Frayne, who's directing the other one, and he saw another Mammoth project I was doing, and with a reference to Mammoth projects I was doing, and he said, are you one of them? Wouldn't be Oleana, would it? And I was like, yep. He's like, we're doing it too. I was like, ah, well, we're not backing off this time, so let's just try to help each other.
Yeah.
I think Vancouver's a big enough city that two productions of the same play don't have to be a bad thing. It's happened a couple of times this season. The Arts Club and Little Mountain, I mean, and Main Street Theater both did The Odd Couple, very, you know, straight-ahead comedy. Two very successful, quite different productions. So I think for people who love theater, seeing kind of real actor-driven shows close to each other can be quite a lot of fun, you know, because you can, I mean, Anthony Ingram is a really fine actor, is playing the same role I am. Susie Cuddon's a really fine actor. They're very different from me in Pandora. You know, they're bound to be quite different interpretations. So I think for people who enjoy theater, fascinating, and of course for people who miss our production, poor devils, they have a chance to make it to the other one.
Yeah, well, they shouldn't miss your production, and
well, no, it would be foolish in the extreme to miss our production. But
yeah.
Should a tragedy like that occur, they have a second chance to see the show.
Indeed, yeah. At the end of Shannon's piece in the Tai, she said that the two groups are coming together for a sort of panel discussion on the play itself, on the work itself.
Yes, we're doing a matinee on Thursday the 24th, a 2 o'clock afternoon show, and then after that show, we're going to have a talk back. But we're going to invite the other company to be part of that talk back so that, you know, so that there's insight from various different approaches to the piece, responses. And it should also be very interesting for them, of course, to hear an audience respond to the play. I'm assuming that the actors in that production are not going to watch our production because they're not going to want to be influenced by what we do. But they're going to come in and, you know, talk and be with the audience and see the response. My mother was at the talk back for the Playhouse production 20 years ago, and she said it was strange and horrifying. She said the anger that people felt towards the woman in the show was so palpable. There were people screaming at each other during the thing. I know an actress in town who told me that when she made the statement that regardless of what had happened, it's not legitimate to beat a woman, somebody threatened to hit her.
Wow.
And it was just like, I mean, it's, you know, it really was divisive. And, you know, I mean, of course, you want to have an effect on an audience. So on one hand, it's wonderful. But I'm hoping that the conversation will, if people are upset, that it's not going to be, it's not going to be that kind of a conversation.
Yeah. But what do you think? I mean, what you're telling me, and what I'm thinking of where we are, I guess, in Vancouver or in the culture as it is, it's a different place than it was 20 years ago in a way, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. I've been part-time teaching in, you know, post-secondary institutions for almost 20 years now on various different things. And, you know, when I was in school, when I was in theater school, it was kind of a given, as far as most of us were concerned, the teachers and students would sometimes sleep together. Like that, I'm sure that some people found that dismaying or weird, but I don't remember any of us thinking it was unusual. It was just like, well, that happens. By the time I came into the system to work, there was a lot more consciousness of why that was just a really bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of, and most, you know, even by 20 years ago, most colleges and universities that I was aware of had or were instituting sexual and ways to make sure that teachers weren't, you know, asking for sexual favors in exchange for grades, or, you know, all that kind of thing. And it seemed like it was, you know, around the time of the play, if you'd asked me, I would have said, well, it's, you know, the power is being balanced with these rules and regulations. But I just read an article the other day about teachers at Northwestern University. I can't remember the name of the university now, but where teachers were starting to talk about striking because there was a very high-profile professor who had been caught sexually harassing a student, and he had the discipline for it. It had just been basically, you're going to teach some sensitivity training. And the other professors felt that it was not enough, that he had done serious harm, that it was acknowledged, and that the school wasn't, it was just giving him a slap on the wrist. So, you know, when people in power want to protect each other, they will. And I guess this subject is coming up. I mean, the thing about this show, of course, that's different from that is this situation is way more ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where things get difficult. But, God, I'm really avoiding answering your question, aren't I, which is it different?
Yeah, because we went through a period 20 years ago, say, of heightened political correctness. That sort of waned a bit, and then it's sort of back, but it's back in a different way.
I think, I think the whole... I mean, I'm always a little bit... the term political correctness is, of course, a great stick to beat people with when they're...
doing something wrong?
It's also a great stick to beat people with when they're trying to address things that are wrong. You know, like, oh, you're just being politically correct. Oh, you have no sense of humor, whatever. Yeah. And within that phrase, as soon as you get tarred with that phrase, it's like you're taking a wide range of things, from people genuinely addressing problems to possibly people who are trying to legislate kindness. You know, there are times when people are trying to find ways to address things with a legal or system that are just human nature, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, it's a phrase that I'm always a little suspicious of. You know, it used to be a joke among the left. That was, political correctness was just a way of teasing each other. And then, like, when people decided that it was a serious thing and that it was the greatest threat to freedom of speech in the Western world and so on. And I think we face much greater threats to freedom of speech than political correctness.
Yeah.
I think slap suits by major oil corporations are probably greater threats to freedom of speech. But that said, the whole question of how you legislate, whether you legislate what people can say,
mm-hmm.
it always gets interesting.
This is a David Mamet play, and most people remember him from, say, Glengarry Glen Ross or American mm-hmm. Buffalo.
Yeah.
Most people now know him as the dad of one of the girls on Girls.
Oh, I've heard that.
Yeah. In terms of the language that you speak as an actor, in terms of his writing,
mm-hmm.
what are his strengths as a playwright, and what do we see in Oleana that makes him as highly regarded as he is?
He has always had one of the most amazing ears for human speech of any writer in the English language, modern writer in the English language, I think. And he said once, you know, that if you grew up in a family where nobody was honest, you learned to really listen to what was being hidden under what was being said. And I think you can see that. And he understands the way people use language, not so much to communicate as to avoid communicating, to cover, to say things without saying them, to avoid being pinned down. His language is, it's elliptical, it moves around the subject. People cheat with language all the time. My character, for instance, speaks huge long sentences with very tortured syntax. He hides behind walls of words. Funny that they would cast me in that part. I think most of us who dialogue, take lessons from Mamet, you know, one way or another, whether we like his politics or not. I don't think there's anybody to touch him for just the crazy poetic rhythms of human speech. He's kind of, the plays you mentioned are also, you know, he's also always had a real kind of an understanding of a way a lot of men operate in the world, and he's very much a male playwright. His women characters generally have not been as strong as his men.
Uh-huh.
Probably one of the reasons why he has a reputation among some people for being misogynist. I think, you know, but he has a real sense for a lot of the ugliness of male power struggles. So I think, you know, even if he may not often write women as well as he writes men, but when he writes men, he doesn't shy away from the ugliness of male behavior. And I think that's one of the places where his analysis is fascinating. He's also traditionally known for a lot of coarse language, and there's almost none in this play. There's very, very little in the way of swearing in this play, whereas Glengarry and American Buffalo and a lot of the famous earlier plays, you know, it's just like sort of a constant stream of poetic vulgarity.
Yeah. Now, so I looked you up in preparing for the interview, and I looked at some of your credits, and I think the only thing I've seen you in Vancouver is the Playhouse's production of Frost Nixon.
Oh, you didn't see much of me in that.
No, you played Mike Wallace, right?
I played Mike Wallace, and they ended up putting that on film, and I played a floor director. That's the best paid job I've ever had in theater, and probably the least effort I've had to make in almost any show I've ever done.
Because I'm curious about Nixon, and and of course interviewing people as I do, David Frost and Mike Wallace are two of the best. What sort of preparation did you do for a role like that? Or I mean, did you study Nixon at all? I mean, I know you weren't playing Nixon per se, but I mean,
we all watched, of course, you know, the actual interviews. I watched a lot of Mike Wallace, mainly. Some people are really good mimics. Some people can really imitate people, and that's not one of my strengths as an actor. I'm not a good mimic. So I didn't try to imitate Wallace, but I did try to catch a sense of his phrasing and the way that he would break up words and so on. I mean, it was there wasn't a lot to do. The best part of the best part of that whole experience for me was when the show moved to Toronto. I did come out of the stage door one time, and somebody said, a few other people had seen the show, said, hey, that guy was in the show, you'll know. Hey, tell us, that Mike Wallace bit, was that archival recording? And I was like, no, that was me. So that was kind of great.
Yeah.
Really, you know, meanwhile, while I was playing on video, the actual me was sitting backstage waiting to move furniture.
the theater scene in Vancouver, I'm always fascinated by that because I have a lot of you folks on who are craftsmen and who work in the biz, if you will.
Right.
How is it? It seems it's really vibrant and lively, is it?
It's a weird thing in Vancouver because from an audience perspective, Vancouver's not a big theater town. It's not like Winnipeg or Toronto or Montreal where audiences are really, where theater feels like it's a part of the fabric of the city and life. There's a very small percentage of people who actually go to the theater in Vancouver, and most of us don't seem to be very good businessmen. I think we don't really know how to sell what we have. We haven't figured out how to articulate it to the people who aren't already interested in it. And I think that's the feeling that we have that I'm more and more aware of. But at the same time, you know, we have some amazing people doing, you know, right from the traditional mainstream stuff to some very interesting alternative weird stuff in little tiny places. It's a really such an incredible mix of people. And when I was first out of theater school, like in 1980, there was basically a theater community.
Uh-huh.
Now I would say there's about 5 to 8 theater communities that overlap and intersect, but a lot of them, you know, there are people who work for Bart on the Beach and Gateway and the Arts Club who are only barely aware of some of the work that's being done by Progress Labs and some of the, you know, alternative companies, and vice versa, people who work for these, you know, who do unusual movement-based exploration, who don't really pay attention to classical theater or whatever. So it's become, in terms of practitioners, it's become so big and so varied that there really are a variety of schools, you know, a variety of kind of different communities. And I've been lucky enough to have a little tiny part of myself in a great many of them, which is kind of neat, because I find myself kind of frequently falling in love with actors and directors and writers all over again when I, you know, I see the love and the care and the dedication that they put into making the work that they do.
Yeah. Often. Yeah, and there's good stuff for audiences, isn't there?
There is, but there's also so much stuff,
yeah.
And so much of it is happening in small, out-of-the-way places. I mean, you know, look at us. We're doing 6 performances over a, you know, like over a 12-day period at odd times. It's, you know, if you don't know where to look for it, sometimes it's hard to find what's out there, and that's kind of a classic thing for Vancouver. But yeah. Absolutely, it's there's stuff for almost any taste here.
Yeah, and so if people want to see Oleana, they should email coleana@gmail.com, right?
That's right, and we look forward to seeing them there.
Indeed. David, break a leg, as they say. Thanks for this.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Oleana will be at the Little Mountain Gallery. That's at Main and 26th, the 19th through the 27th of April, 2014, 7:30. Is the show time, but do email them if you need more information. coleana@gmail.com. David Bloom joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.